Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure now to welcome Eric Loomis. He is a professor of history at the University of Rhode Island. He's the author of Out of Sight and the author of a new book, A History of America in 10 Strikes by Eric Loomis. A History of America in 10 Strikes. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
This is such an interesting book, in part because this is history that we just don't hear in schools. We didn't grow up hearing the stories of labor, first of all, of strikes, second of labor, and even more so of class in this country. It's just not something that's taught.
Yeah, well, you know, this is a problem. And, you know, what this book tries to do is to think about what if you took American history and you put class conflict at the center of it? What if you viewed the big changes of American history through this issue of class, particularly looking at strikes as a useful moment where these issues of class become most clear? And what then happens? How does your view of American history change? And so that's the goal, and not in a sense to romanticize the American labor movement or anything like that, but rather to show how the struggle for worker dignity has been at the center of much of American history, including issues that often are not discussed in terms of work, such as slavery, for instance, gender relations, immigration, other key themes of American history, if we consider them in terms of their interaction or relationship with work and class, it really shines a new light on these issues and all of American history.
It really does, because you've hit on something here that is a unifying theme for almost all Americans, and there aren't that many unifying themes anymore. But one thing that we do is pretty much everybody in this country works at some point or another in their life.
Right. I mean, you know, it's interesting because this is so central to our existence. You know, maybe it's not quite as necessary as food and sleep, but certainly it is a central experience of the human being. And that is in the United States and globally, as we all pretty much work in some way or another. And if we don't work, you know, either that is we've retired, let's say, and we have enjoyed, you know, we're trying to hopefully enjoy the fruits of a lifetime of work, or if we're unemployed, that's a huge social stigma, because that's the equivalent of somebody not playing their designated part in what it means to be a human in this country. And some would argue that's a bad thing, and, you know, maybe we shouldn't emphasize work so much and have more vacation or relaxation. And hey, sure, I agree with that. But work is a central a part of the American experience. It's central to American mythology. It's central to the economy. Our welfare state is based off of work. And so, you know, by centering this experience of work and what it means today and in the past, as well as thinking about in the future, hopefully we can change the conversation around this central issue and focus more on gaining greater worker rights for everybody.
Well, and you talk about this in the book, we might like to believe that if all the workers got together and acted for our rights, well, the workers could win whatever we want. In theory, if everybody walked off the job, maybe it could happen. But that's not quite how it works out, is it?
No, it sounds nice, and it's very romantic to think that, you know, we could all step off on a general strike and the revolution would happen. I mean, that was basically, you know, one of our largest or most important labor movements in American history, the industrial workers of the world. That's pretty much how they thought change would take place. But the reality is that each of us has multiple identities, right? And, you know, so we may be a worker, but we may also have a racial identity, a class, a gender identity, a religious identity. We have all sorts of identities that create the people that we are. And those identities do not always agree. And I think one of the things that I really focus on in the book is considering the question, why is it that American workers don't hold more power? Why is it that the white working class, they vote, quote, against their interest, as many on the left would ask? But they're not really voting against their interests. They're voting against their class interests. But they are voting for what they perceive as their interest in being white, in being male, in opposing abortion, whatever it may be. Those identities so often in American history, not always, but often, are more important to these workers than their class identity. And so realizing that, understanding that's central to understanding all of American history, including labor history, and then trying to deal with that in a very upfront way, I think is crucial if we are to build a movement that is an inclusive labor movement that helps all workers and not just one sector of the working class.
I think you bring up some important points in the book. The struggle against racism and the struggle against poverty are not separate. They are together. And as I was reading through parts of this book, I was reminded of a speech that Dr. King gave in Montgomery, where he talked about the working poor, those people who are at the bottom rung of the ladder of success. Well, they could always look down on someone else who didn't even have a finger on the ladder. And the white working class could look down on the black slave. And after slavery, they could look down on the black sharecropper. And the white man was at least not as bad off as the black man. And if the white man then tried to demand the necessities of his low wages could not provide, well, he could look at the signs on the buses. He could look at the signs on the drinking fountains and in the stores. And he would know that his plight could always be a little bit worse, no matter how hungry the white worker and his children were, no matter how empty their bellies, they could still feed on Jim Crow. That was what Dr. King called the last outpost of psychological oblivion.
Yes. I mean, I think that's of course, you know, King was so right about that, and I'm glad you brought that up. And that's critical. I mean, it's how the white Southern elites got poor Southern whites to fight for them during the Civil War. It's how they stopped the attempts at building interracial coalitions after the war for the benefit of both black and white workers. And it's not just a Southern thing. That's been actually in some ways pretty central to much of American history. I mean, the American labor movement, it identified as, when the American labor movement thought what did it mean to be an American worker? This is not today, but this is for much of the past. They really thought of it in terms of a white American. That is what being a proper American worker was. And so, the American labor movement for many, many years was deeply opposed to immigration. The first major national law comes out of the American labor movement that gets passed by Congress and signed by the president is the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was an 1882 law eliminating Chinese immigration, and that came out of the labor movement in California. That's what they were organizing over. Mm-hmm. And so, today, thankfully, the labor movement has changed, and now it's an enormous ally of the immigrant rights movement because it realizes that the future of the American working class is people of color, it's women, it's immigrants, it's a diverse world that we live in. But for large portions of the white working class, they're resenting this. They don't like it when they have to hear Spanish. They don't like diversity at work, and they too often they think that what it means to be an American worker should still be jobs for white males. And so this is a challenge that the American worker faces. And it's a challenge we face if we're going to create a strong labor movement in the future. We can't. I think it's very important. One of the lessons I take out of this, I hope readers take out of this book, is that you cannot apologize or mollify racism in order to create a better labor movement. You have to face racism straight on. You have to reject it. And you have to create a series of policies that will hopefully appeal to workers of all races by being aggressive and forward thinking enough that hopefully for at least some white workers it pulls them away from that white identity and toward a greater class identity because they're going to see it as so much in their interest to promote this agenda. So I think that's the goal. I think that's what we have to do as for those of us who are committed to a powerful labor movement in the future.
And you talked about those specific issues, I think probably in the chapter that dealt with the Justice for Janitors strikes, which is one of the more recent strikes that we've seen, one of 10 that you cover in great detail in the book, by the way, just a marvelous story. Talk to us briefly about Justice for Janitors.
I close with these strikes that took place in the 1990s in particularly in Los Angeles, also in Washington and other cities where, you had much of the modern economy is being created. Many of the problems that we face today are being created by this time. And so you had these janitors that had union contracts in downtown buildings, but we were entering a period both of union busting, which continues today. The total number of union members in the nation continues to decline, combined with new ideas about subcontracting and outsourcing and other ways that corporations were unloading responsibility. And so the big building contractor or the big building owners in places like downtown Los Angeles began to contract out to cleaning companies, and they would bust the union contract. They would they would drastically lower wages, et cetera, et cetera. And so what the union did, this is the Service Employees International Union, which is today one of the large unions in the country, largely representing low-wage workers and immigrants and workers of color and women, is that they engaged in some very innovative and interesting strike actions in front of these large office buildings. And, you know, part of the reason that it worked is that if you're working in one of these office buildings, as no doubt many of your listeners do, you know, you don't see the people cleaning your offices and your bathrooms. You just want them clean. They're in there at night. And so, you know, it's these workers, all they want is for this problem to go away. And the companies that maybe are renting a floor of that building, they just want it to go away. And so by disrupting those companies and those employees, they put pressure on the building owners themselves to come to negotiate a deal. And then when the Los Angeles police in one action begins to beat these strikers, that then gains national sympathy for this strike, led primarily by immigrants, many of them who had fled violence in the 1980s in Central America. They're from El Salvador, they're from Guatemala, they're from Honduras. And they openly said, you know, they had dealt with real violence at home. They're not particularly scared of going out on strike, so they were really militant. And they won. And it was this amazing victory that really begins to make the labor movement what it is today, which is a pro-immigrant movement, one that is allied with many, many progressive elements in society, a real transformation of what the labor movement used to be. And so that Just for Janitors story, which is what I close with, is it really hopes to provide a more inspirational story and a path forward for those of us who want a better workplace.
Before closing with the Justice for Janitors story, right before that is the story of PATCO, the air traffic controllers, in the 80s, and how this was a major defeat for unions, and really I think an inflection point for organized labor in this country. I think most of us are old enough to remember that when the air traffic controllers went on strike, Reagan basically said, "That's it, you're fired."
Yes, it's really the most disastrous strike in all of American labor history. You know, I mean, in the 1930s, after a century of struggle and mostly failure, organized labor wins enormous gains. And this is when you see the creation of your basic labor law, a Christian National Labor Relations Board that mediates between employers and employees and forces employers to recognize unions and sign contracts, the creation of the 8-hour day, the minimum wage, time and a half for overtime, the weekend, all of these things that we think of as hallmarks of what middle-class life really is in America. And that continues pretty solidly, really, until 1981. In 81, Reagan takes power. And this is, you know, Reagan is reflective of a newly emboldened conservative movement, one that, of course, remains only more powerful today than it was, than it was 37 years ago. And, you know, it's very interesting because the air traffic controllers, which had a very bad relationship with Jimmy Carter, actually endorsed Ronald Reagan. They were one of the only unions to endorse Reagan in 1980. Which is really striking.
I read that and I was like, oh, I did not recall that being the case, but what a shocker.
Yeah. And then, you know, so they think Reagan's going to be on their side. They had talked to Reagan a little bit about some of their issues, and Reagan had vaguely given a word of support. I mean, they took it far too literally. And so when they go on strike in 1981, they feel they're going to win because, first of all, they control the nation's air traffic. And so it's going to effectively shut down the airline industry. But Reagan, who, you know, sees this as law-breaking, and technically it is law-breaking for federal employees to go on strike, and also wants to look tough early in his presidency, this is shortly after he had been shot, he sees this as an opportunity, and he orders the strikers back to work and says, you're all going to be fired if you don't.
And a lot of them were fired. Hang on just a moment.
Yeah, over
11,000. We'll take a quick break. We'll continue this conversation with Eric Loomis, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Back in just a moment. thank you so much for joining us. We're talking with Eric Loomis. He is the author of A History of America in 10 Strikes, also the author of Out of Sight, but the new book, and this is a really intriguing book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. And I say it's intriguing in part because this is not what you hear in regular history books or not what you learned in school. And yet strikes are particularly special moments because they affect us in so many different ways and affect so many of us in so many different ways. Look back, you can probably remember some of the strikes in your lifetime. We were just talking about the PATCO strike, the air traffic controllers strike back in 1980, and how Reagan fired the air traffic controllers when they went on strike. That was a pivotal moment. That was a moment when organized labor basically lost all power. The pendulum swung. Is it going to swing back? And specifically, I'm thinking now about what we've seen just this past year with teachers going on strike and actually getting some progress.
Yeah, this swings two ways. And in some ways, these are very grim times because of the Supreme Court, you know, that the Supreme Court, it now, like a century ago, is effectively creating new categories of speech only to restrict labor unions' ability to operate. This was in the Janus versus Aspen case that was decided in 2018 that undermined public sector unions, government workers, their ability to operate, particularly in the political realm. And, you know, this the combination of a right-wing presidency and Supreme Court and Congress makes it very, very difficult structurally for labor unions to do anything. On the other hand, one point I want to make throughout the book is that you never know what worker struggles are going to look like, and workers will continue to struggle, whether in unions or outside of unions, in order to have a dignified life. And so, you know, at the same time that you have this crackdown and increasing restrictions on what unions could do, you have all this grassroots efforts popping up. And we've seen teachers really in the last several years, going back to, say, the Chicago teacher strike in 2012, that won some big victories, really be at the forefront of the modern labor movement. And you know, the fact that it's very interesting because these teacher strikes in early 2018, you know, they were in some of our most conservative states like West Virginia and Oklahoma. And so many of these teachers are not liberals. Many of them are Trump voters. And they, however, saw, you know, their own lives as one of oppression, and they have struck and had huge wins. And in Oklahoma, you know, any state legislator who voted against the tax increase to fund their increased salaries, they have defeated almost all of those in primaries. And so this is quite a movement, and we'll see where it leads. But there's no question we're in a moment where a lot of people are standing up in a way that they have not stood up before. And I think that we're going to see more and more of these kind of labor struggles coming out of places we don't expect as the conditions of work continue to deteriorate in this country.
And yet there is a structure in place underlying all this. We have a service economy based around low-wage jobs without union protections, at the same time that we have corporate outsourcing, globalization, the closing of American plants. Do you really think that we're going to see much change as far as organized labor is concerned?
Well, I don't think you're going to see much change in terms of the structure of the economy. I mean, the closed factories are not going to come back, and even if they did, they would be all automated. They're not going to employ thousands of people like they used to. And I think that one thing that's important to remember about a revived labor movement is that 100 years ago, factory job was not a good job. It was a terrible job. It was a job where people died, where you got paid nothing, where workplace safety was non-existent. And it was a time when the courts and corporations and politicians all united to stop labor movements from winning. Yeah. And yet 20 years later, they had achieved enormous victories. And so there's no reason to think that can't happen again. There's also no reason to think it's going to be easy to make that happen. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
Cautiously optimistic. This was an amazing book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Taking a look at the labor movement, I can guarantee you'll learn something out of this book that you did not know before. And it's just a marvelously written book. And it tells an extremely compelling story, A History of America in 10 Strikes by Eric Loomis. Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.